This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 405 for January 5 of 2018. How to engineer a CUV. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Well, Gary, Happy New Year.
Same to you. Gee, it's 2018, and I think it's like 18 below outside right now.
It is. It's cold, but it's a great way to kick off the year to get
it
the
is.
Show going again.
Absolutely.
And we got to tell everybody, James Ammon from Ward's Auto is here with us.
Good to be here.
Great to have you here in the studio.
Thanks.
With us. And, of course, our special guest for today is Rick Spina. He's the executive chief engineer for crossovers at General Motors. And we even have a brand new Buick Enclave in the studio with
us. It
was
nice of us to bring that along.
It was very nice of you guys to do that.
It's as clean as you're going to see it, minus 18.
Yeah. Well, they detailed it here in the studio. That's why the floor of the studio is still kind of a mess.
Oh, and it just always looks like that, right?
I mean,
It's the invisible force field we're working on to throw salt and dirt away from the finish.
That's
Man,
right.
You guys are so advanced.
It's an option package.
Not quite available yet. We'll let you know.
So, Rick, here you got these full-size SUVs. Tell us about what's the breadth of this program, because there's multiple brands. Is there multiple manufacturing facilities?
Yeah. Just one?
Okay. Well, tell us about it.
Okay,
you fill
sure.
in the
I'll be
details.
Happy to. So if we talk for a couple of minutes, Buick Enclave first. So the way to answer your question is Buick Enclave is just one assembly facility, and that's probably built by the people in Lansing, Michigan. So that works out nicely on that one. But if you talk about the breadth of the family here of these crossover, the crossovers of sort of this family here, we do have kind of all the GM brands represented and produced in a couple different facilities. In this case, two here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So Cadillac XT5 and the GMC Acadia, Chevy Traverse, Buick Enclave, all built here in the States, which works out nicely. And then we build them in China, too.
Yeah.
The Cadillac, especially right now in China, and there's some other stuff coming.
Yeah. So when did you start this program of redoing this these vehicles?
Generally, our programs take about 4 years, roughly, so to speak. So if you clock this thing back four years and change, which will quickly tell you, okay, so when I go back to the office here, I'm looking 4 years out, for what's coming on the next ones, too. So we've got this sort of, I would say, interesting time horizon, because we've got the immediateness of today. What are we selling today? What's going down the line at Lansing right this minute as we speak? During the course of our conversations here, we'll build, 30 of these things or so, roughly, right? So that's the immediacy of today versus what's going to happen tomorrow and next month. What do we have to be ready for? And then 4 or 5 years from now, what do we need to do on the next one?
Man, it right? never
so
stops.
It doesn't, and that's kind of what makes it fascinating, right? It's a fun business. I sort of joke a bit, and forgive me for the digression, but the business model is like lemonade stand, right? I mean, you come up with a recipe, you taste it, you decide if it's okay, and you sell it, and you see how it works. But there's so many nuances and so many pieces of this, it gets a little more fascinating than lemonade, probably. I've never been in the lemonade business, but there's a lot to it.
Well, Rick, I mean, the Enclave has been a very successful vehicle right. since day one.
Yep.
Okay, so when you guys were looking at, okay, we've got to do a new one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so what were the things that you took into consideration? I mean, was it a lot of benchmarking against other products out there? Was it listening to the customer? Was it both of those things? Was it neither of those things?
No.
And something else?
It was actually all of those things. So thanks for asking it that way. First of all, as you mentioned at the beginning of your question, the Enclave has been very successful for us with a very loyal follower, very loyal customer base. Now, because we've got sort of multiple entries in sort of this three row, bigger than midsize SUV, we're able to say, okay, let's keep our Enclave customers, our traditional ones, keep them very happy, make them happier. So let's do more of the same for them. Can I make sure it's luxurious? Can I make sure it's quiet? Can I make sure it meets all of my general expectations without being brash, if you will? My words, not official words, but that's what we did for that one. And, its sculptural beauty really was a big deal when we first did the first Enclave, so we'll make sure this Enclave was the same. And when I say that, I also have the, we also have the luxury, because we got the Buick brand and some other brands, we wouldn't necessarily have to dive, I'll say, way down into an area we might not want to take Buick. We can do that with some of the other entries. Mm-hmm. And also on the top end, same thing. So we try to say, what is our customer really like? Current customer, can we do more of that and do it better and on a more contemporary basis, right? By more contemporary, an example might be the fuel economy, right? We picked up fuel economy nearly 20% on this one over the old one, with fundamentally, well, actually a bigger, a little bit bigger vehicle on the outside, a lot bigger vehicle on the inside, without giving up actually gaining horsepower. Mm-hmm. So I hope that answered your question, but it was more of the same was our approach on this car.
I always like that. Bigger, faster, better fuel economy. That's a pretty good formula.
Welcome to the world of what engineers wish they could do all the time, right?
And I think you got a little bump in power on it.
We did.
As well,
we
which I noticed when I've test driven it. It's the previous 3.6 liter had to work pretty hard.
Correct.
You had it made into that six-speed
yep.
automatic. It had to work pretty hard to get the thing up and running, get it up and going from a stop. This one doesn't seem to work quite as hard.
Thanks for noticing. And it's, you know, I'm really glad you said it. Yeah, it's more horsepower, substantially more horsepower, a bit more torque, 9-speed transmission over 6-speed, mm-hmm. like I mentioned. And the car's, what, 350, 360 pounds lighter, right? All those things are directionally correct for feeling better off the line.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, as things evolve, we get a little better on controls and calibrations and things like that, and that all goes into throttle feel.
Now, does the Avenir trim, mm-hmm. is that something that you as an engineer get involved in, or is that mainly design and marketing?
Yes. So, what's a fun way to say this? Design and the design, marketing, whatever, always have a long list of things they wish we could do, right? And we can do almost anything; we just can't do everything. So we have to constantly decide where do we put the people and the money and the resources. So most of the Avenir was the idea of the marketing and design people. But as the engineering group, we have to say, yes, we can do that, and it makes sense to us. Because we do, it would be not fair of me to say it's all them that decides the content of the vehicle. Because it's really a dance, it's a team effort. What content can we execute easily? What can we be sure we'll do very well? Because we don't want to take on anything we can't do very well. That said, the marketing design guy says, we want this Avenir, what can we get? And this is what we're able to do for him.
And what the content of that, mm-hmm. the Avenir trim line adds, some exterior enhancements.
Correct.
And some mechanical enhancements as well as interior.
Most of the mechanical enhancements you actually can get on the mm-hmm. lower trim, but with the Avenir, we package it all together and say, you've got it all. Just about, there's only one option package mm-hmm. available on that. And the CDC suspension is Avenir only on this car. But to your question, your point, the idea is, okay, I'm going to break Avenir out to be a little bit special, a little bit elite, package it that way, and that really is a marketing vision. And so far, it's working real well. In this enclave, the percentage of Avenir penetration is quite high, mm-hmm. over 35%, I think.
You mentioned that you've taken about 300 pounds out mm-hmm. of this. We got a question from Michael Ma from San Francisco. He wants to know, how do you get your CUVs lighter without making them smaller? You made it bigger and
right.
made it lighter.
That's if I knew you, I'd buy a cup of coffee for asking that question, because I've got an entire team of engineers and manufacturing guys that love to talk about this. The simple way I say this is we ask every engineer to pay a lot of attention to the mass or the weight of their parts. Lots and lots of attention. I know it sounds funny, but if you start saying it really matters, guys, and then you're willing to put some money on it, meaning, hey, guess what? That more expensive material really is more expensive, but it's worth the weight, okay? You can put a value to the weight sometimes if you choose to. You can say it's, you know, whatever it is, a dollar a pound or something like that. You can choose to. But inevitably, if you challenge a good engineer to come up with a better mousetrap, in this case, I'm going to measure the mousetrap in quality and cost and mass, right? They'll start doing it. Now, to get more specific, we took across all our crossovers, we've taken more of an approach that says everybody in for mass and everybody in on different kinds of materials. So in some cases, we'll use traditional steel, especially on the outside of the body, where we've got to have great formability. In other cases, we'll use more difficult to manufacture, but really nice, super strong, more exotic steels, a little more expensive, harder to manufacture, more cost, but that gets you mass. So it's very customized, piece by piece. Mm-hmm. While I'm on the mass thing, I will also tell you that because crossover customers value space. They value space more than size, right? It's that interior space you get, that's what sets you apart. You then say, well, if I could be very, very mass efficient, I can also be very space efficient or size efficient in my structure. Like, think of the column of a building, right? I can have a column this big or a column this big that's load based. our columns are the same way. If I can use a better material, I can get that section smaller. I get the section smaller, there's more room for your stuff.
Yeah, so, and I've heard actually the culture within GM, part of the engineering culture now, is every gram is accounted for. So you come into a meeting with an idea or something like that or a change, you're accountable for every single gram in the vehicle, whereas we used to think in terms of kilogram, now it's every single gram.
That's exactly right.
Culture.
That's exactly right. And quite honestly, one of the nice things about working in a big company like GM is, you know, the Corvette guy sitting in his chair would have always talked about that. And he talked about balance and mass, etc. Well, guess what? We can take all the learnings those guys have on the sports car side that has been desperately necessary and bring it up here because we find attributes here. Now, it does cost money, right? And
so do you put a price on weight?
We do.
And so, I mean, if somebody comes in and says, you know, well, we're going to make this part out of unobtainium, and, you know, it only costs a mint, but it's great stuff. I mean,
we have a
clearly
guideline.
You're not going to do that.
We have a guideline we use, you know, that will say it's a certain pennies per gram or whatever. We use that guideline, and the guideline will vary a little bit based on the product. Some products more important than others. Now, the value of the gram is becoming greater as the fuel economy and GHG laws become tougher. Right, so there's a formula, if you will, on what's the mass relationship to the fuel economy of the car and the regulations. So what we can actually do is we're actually putting more value on the mass than we would have 20 years ago.
Is there a concern that some people might have when, you know, they hear you talk about taking 300 pounds out of this car, saying, did they make it cheaper? Did they make the things, you know, I mean,
it's really quite the opposite. It costs a lot less to do it big and heavy than big and light. You know, aerospace, everyone's used to aerospace being expensive, right? So that's fundamentally really it. If I go back, my toy car is a 58 Oldsmobile, okay? All the sections are huge. It's not very mass efficient, and heavy was considered safer and better, okay? Not the case anymore. Now it's about elegant structures that are extremely stiff, extremely rigid, which, you know, helps for a lot of things, handling as well, safety. And not necessarily cheapest.
Okay, we got a number of other questions here from viewers. Ray Mitrovitz, I hope I said that right. Anything we can look forward to in just the few coming months here in terms of CUVs from General Motors?
In the few coming months, anything coming out in the few coming months, we would have already announced. But the auto show is coming. North America International Auto Show, excuse me. A little myopic here, but that one's coming. So if we've got anything to say, I'm sure we'll say some stuff there.
Oh, okay. And Kenya Catholic says, will we ever see distinctive powertrains from Buick that differentiate them from GMC and Chevrolet?
I don't want to say never. I'm sure we will. Right now on the crossovers, we're not doing that at the moment, but we always could. I made the silly, sort of the silly statement before, we can do anything, we can't do everything. Some of that comes down, if we decide to do unique powertrains for any brand, then it just means that that's some resource we can't use to do something else. So we just have to decide where is the value there.
So back in the day, you were assistant chief engineer on the Bravada, Trailblazer, and what was the other?
Great memory. Envoy.
Envoy.
Very good memory, yeah.
Okay. 360s.
Yep. GMT 360, as they were called, yep.
So it seems that you guys do these things in threes, right? So what are the differences fundamentally between the Chevy, the Buick, and the GMC in this case, because we don't have Oldsmobile anymore?
Sure, right. We don't have Oldsmobile anymore, right. If I start from the outside and look in, the difference is the persona of the product, the persona of the car and sort of the customer that we think is going to buy it and the customer we're aiming towards. It may sound funny, but our engineering teams, we actually start from the outside and then come back down. Because I joked earlier with a couple of you guys, from an operations perspective, we'd like them all to be the same, right? The old Henry Ford model. We'd like everything to be common. And that's operations all the way down through the supplier at the very lowest end. Yet the customers all expect differentiation. So my answer to your question, Gary, is we try and change what we think is most important to the customer, what will most make that Buick sound and feel like a Buick compared with our other products. We think, and I agree, I would tell you, I very much think that the customer that buys this car doesn't really care that the floorboards, my dad would say, the underbody of the car, or the motor compartment rails, they don't really care whether they're the same on two cars or 2 million cars. kind of don't care. They don't. So we don't specifically try and make the Chevy different from the Buick in that area. But what I touch, what I feel, what I listen to a little bit, we do think matters, and that's what we try and do the focus. So the difference is in those kind of interface parts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the primary area.
Okay.
Well, the one thing that I noticed in my test drives of the vehicle is you mentioned the difference between those and the family. Mm-hmm. Is the quietness inside the Buick and some of the things you guys do with some active noise canceling and stuff. I don't know if you want to say a few words about that, but you can really tell when you get that thing loaded up with people and you start having a conversation how different the experience can be.
Yep. Thanks for noticing. For Buick, it's absolute focus across all the Buick products. Really focused on that quiet tuning. And I think the original Enclave was really started to push that real hard if you go back that 6-7 years ago. But yeah, that is a clear and important focus on the Buick, that we make sure that the quiet tuning is there. I was mentioning a little before on Mass, we talk about money. In some cases, I vote with money, right? Inside the product, I vote with money. Customer has to vote with their money. So we do. We vote with money. We'll spend money to make sure that quiet tuning is what it needs to be. A little extra sound absorption. Make sure that the glass, something like glass, mm-hmm. to pick up the thickness of glass, the acoustic treatments on the glass, et cetera, will bias ourselves towards making sure those are all top shelf for the Buick. And it is noticeable. I agree with you. So thanks for pointing it out.
There's so much talk about electric vehicles these mm-hmm. days. GR wrote in to ask, are there any plans for an EV version of the Enclave?
GM has a lot of EV plans.
Yeah.
Okay, but I'm not working on an EV Enclave right now.
GM's talking about a specific EV architecture, right, for doing it. So this would not be a candidate for...
This architecture is not set up to be an EV by itself. One can always electrify things
right.
and choose to, and you know, I can't really go too far on that. But
right.
And there may be an EV Enclave, too. It just wouldn't be something I'm working on right now.
Right. Pretty much everything's going to get electrified, don't you think?
Over
some sort of hybrid version of everything.
Probably. I hate to be. Now I'm not speaking as a corporate. I'm speaking as Rick.
Yeah,
My view on this is yes, but the internal combustion engine and the whole fuel industry, et cetera, will, I think, continue to fight hard, economically fight hard, to say, geez, we can keep our costs down, and so it won't be a natural, easy switch over to electric from a money perspective,
mm-hmm.
right? A lot of infrastructure still has to happen. That said, some electrification is going to happen. It just depends on how much and how fast, I think.
But supplement, I think what John's saying is more hybridization of vehicles.
Yes, absolutely.
For sure.
That's relatively easy to do, right?
Yeah, right. It's relatively easy. It's not, you know, it's not inventing anything completely new now. It's just application of known technologies. And it very much gets back to, you know, sort of my theme. I didn't mean to be, but my theme is where we spend our dollars,
yeah.
right? Because if you vote with money on electrification on the car, then the cost of the vehicle goes up, but you get a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is that what our customer wants?
What are your thoughts on active aero? We're starting to see a lot of that show up.
Yep. Yeah, I suspect active aero goes in the recipe for fuel economy and greenhouse gas. It's really kind of fun, right? If I remember my engineering correctly, aerodynamic drag is like a cubic function with speed,
mm-hmm.
right? Whereas mass is just...
It's just
get
there.
It moving, it's just there, right? Yeah. So as you start to look at highway fuel economy, aero becomes super important. So, you know, smart, deployable air dams and things like that absolutely are going to keep coming. Now, as you're seeing it already on the top end of the market.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a value proposition for the rest of us, just like dollars for a gram,
mm-hmm.
right? And so what's the dollar for a count of drag?
Mm-hmm.
So your job takes you all CUVs, so not just
I've got
larger,
compact
larger than midsize.
Yep, I've got the C segment and D segment.
Okay. And so, you know, across the board, I mean, every OEM in the world is making vehicles in this category.
Yep.
And I mean, and consumers seem to be snapping them up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, I mean, what are the things that you consider to make your vehicle the one that people prefer, the one that people seek out, the people want?
There's not a single item. Crossovers are absolutely still want to be the Swiss Army knife for most people. Mm-hmm. They really do. It depends. You know, if I work on the extreme lux, it's a little different, right, than the more pedestrian kind of products. But for sure, it wants to be the Swiss Army knife. So it's kind of funny, but the Karate Kid, you know, the single kick at the end, right, the mm-hmm. Seahawk or the Seagull stance, that's what I was looking for, Seagull stance. We joke a little bit on the team, but that's kind of what we keep trying to go for. How can we be right down the middle for everybody? Certain things matter a lot, matter more than others, but for sure, how am I down the middle? To more t- pointedly answer your question, if I look at, let's say, Chevrolet, right, on Equinox and Traverse, the big two there, I want to make sure I'm not disappointing anybody. I can't. By disappointing, I mean you have to have somewhere to plug in your phone, right? You have to have somewhere to put your water bottle, right? They expect these things. And, of course, the car has to start at a minus 15, right? But it's, I can't let anybody down. Now, if I was working on a $100,000 crossover, okay, I have to go way beyond not disappointing people. I have to excite you mm-hmm. a lot in some certain aspects. So if you take what I just said and you piece that down, if I'm talking about an XT5 on my team versus an Equinox, I'll have a slightly different view on just making sure I don't disappoint versus exciting and delighting. James asked about the Buick and the quiet tuning on the Buick. We see that as an exciter or a delighter, right? It's extra quiet, and I relish the fact that I bought the Buick and it is extra quiet.
Mm-hmm. And that to me, and it, I don't know if this is a observation or a question, but that to me seems to be the big thing that's confronting people, especially from a styling perspective. You know, I know we're talking engineering here, but we'll do our competitions, you know, awards, 10 best engines or 10 best interiors or 10 best UX, and I'll go out in the parking garage to the vehicle that I'm going to drive for that night, and I'll look, and they all look the same, and I have to hit the key fob to figure out which CUV I'm taking home. So you have that real big challenge there in the middle of the market of trying to differentiate these vehicles, right. And it's very hard when it's that same two-box design.
Yep. It is a fashion business, you know, a technical fashion and aesthetic fashion. I would tell you that I think we're really fortunate at GM because we've got some really great styling people, and they all come to GM and relish the idea that they've got these different brands to work with. So Buick has been really fortunate, very expressive, and I would be really surprised if hitting the bipper for your Buicks, you know, for our Buick was the same as some of the others, but yes, that is clearly an important differentiator. If there's only a certain chunk of the auto market in North America that is okay with, meaning they don't care what it looks like. There's only a certain kind of buyer that doesn't care, and we know who the, you know, we sort of understand those people too. They're very, you know, they're very straightforward, practical, pragmatic more people, and there's others that want to have the passion, the visual passion for the car, the aesthetic. I want it to look really nice when I walk up to it. I want to make a statement about who I am, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. We've got a number of other quick questions here. So Ray wants to know, what are you driving daily?
Actually, this is going to sound like baloney, but it's true. The last 3 weeks I've been driving an Enclave. In fact, I put 2,000 miles on one here just over the Christmas, you know, the 10 days off, all in nasty, nasty-ass weather, and I'm happy to say it worked out really well. I do tend to drive what the products that we work on, but I have my 58 Olds convertible that I like driving in the summer just because it's a good cruiser, and I will admit that most summers I end up with a couple of months of a Camaro convertible for a couple of months every summer.
Okay, Joel Rollins wants to know, does the Enclave offer a heads-up display?
No.
Okay. You want to add to that, or I can go to the next question?
Stay tuned.
Okay, stay tuned. John Anderson wants to know, can you explain GM and Buick's reasons for offering many active safety features like lane assist, adaptive cruise control, only on upper-level models?
Sure. Yeah. When you asked earlier how long ago we've been working, on these about 4 years. When we took a look at, we did lots of customer, you know, clinics, interfaces, et cetera. We tried to use our crystal ball and figure out what's most important to people. The clinics told us that the rear-facing stuff was most important to them. By that, I mean, what's behind me? What's my blind zone look like? Can I see behind me? For sure, all the clinics told us that's what people cared most about 4 years ago. You roll forward. Right now, you've got Toyota and Honda, a couple of those making a lot of those things standards, the forward one standards. They tend to be quite expensive. The supply base is still coming up. There may not be enough to go around for everybody. We chose to focus on the rear-facing stuff and put those all the way down the trim levels and save the more expensive stuff for the upper trim levels. Mm-hmm. That was a choice we made. A lot of people have asked us questions about it.
So this would be blind spot detection?
Correct. Oh, correctly. Blind spot detection. Exactly.
Okay. Alexander Karabitsis wants a clarification. Are the Enclave and Traverse categorized as seven-passenger D-segment crossovers or E-segment?
They're classified as D-segment from all I know, that the very upper end of the midsize of D-segment, from everything I'm aware of. There are some eight-passenger variants, too, but, you know, you get into these blurry things. I mean, I find it interesting that the midsize SUV segment is two rows and three rows with no differentiation in between. Yeah, we know for sure the customers care a lot about the differences. When you actually start to look, it's very, very muddy. But thanks for asking.
Well, you call this a midsize.
I did.
The Enclave.
Right.
And I think, isn't that in a way sort of the way the showroom breaks out for you folks? Because we would consider this a large crossover, but if you wanted a full-size in the showroom, in the Buick GMC showroom, you would go to the Yukon.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so for us, we do have bigger ones. That's why we consider this. But in many showrooms, this would be the
full-size. It's a big vehicle.
Yeah, it is.
It's a big vehicle. And I'm happy to say I don't think it drives big.
Oh, that's interesting. And that's an interesting term. Explain that a bit, because I only ran into that term recently, that either it drives smaller than it is or it drives bigger than it is. What's that mean?
Typically, the non-engineering version of it is I don't have to think too hard about where the back of the car is or where my fenders are or where my tires are. I don't have to think too hard.
If it
drives smaller. And I can imagine getting in the parking spot, I can get it into the garage.
Yeah, okay. So now, technically, what's that mean?
Technically, I've got to have the suspension set up right, the steering right. It's got to feel nimble and not ponderous. Right? It's got to feel like I'm thinking about moving the car between lanes, I'm thinking about making a move or whatever, and I just do it. Not like I'm planning to do it, and then I go do it.
Like in your Oldsmobile.
Like in my Oldsmobile. My 58 Oldsmobile. I absolutely have to plan way ahead.
Yeah. Like you said, I've driven this a lot, and it does drive smaller than it looks. But once you get into that parking garage,
it's a big vehicle.
It gets really big again. But again, it feels much, much smaller than it is. But.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Another question here. MA7 MGTE, because I don't know how to pronounce that, wants to know, is it real wood inside?
On the steering wheel. On the Avenir steering wheel, that is real wood on top of the Avenir steering wheel. Real wood is always a fun thing to talk about and talk through. There's lots of real wood out there that doesn't look real, and there's lots of fake wood that does look real, and I'll leave it at that. But some of our products have real wood and some don't, and we think through every aspect of that when we do it.
What are you thinking through? Believability on the part of the car buyer.
Right. We're thinking about believability on the part of the car buyer. We're thinking about how important is it that it's real to this particular segment or not. Somebody on the bottom of the market probably is seeing the real wood as a less important feature for them because there is a cost and a price associated with the real wood usually versus the non-real wood. Wood is, by itself is really quite fascinating. I bet you the four of us who went to pick kitchen cabinets will have a very different opinion on which kitchen cabinet wood was the right one. Yet here we have to do a car that all four of us have to agree on that's the right wood, right? So it's really a fun category of its own.
Mm-hmm. It'll soon become a question of carbon fiber or fake carbon fiber.
Oh, right.
Wood will just surpass
it. We already have fake carbon fiber.
Instead of like people asking questions about wood or not wood, it's just like,
sure,
is it real or fake carbon fiber? Is that metal or is that, pleddel?
And the beauty of the open market, right, is that as real wood continues to be desirable, the guys that are making the almost real wood keep getting better and better and better and better at it, right? So I think right now, appearance-wise, with the exception of some of the very exotic open pore woods, the films and things can look very realistic, right? So now they don't have the touch yet. So the touch on the real wood. The problem is if we make real wood very, very durable, you start to lose a lot of the touch, too.
That's right. It's usually so coated with stuff, it feels like plastic.
And so then that becomes the conundrum. And then if you're the average, the average non-caring engineer, a sub-average non-caring engineer, you go, well, geez, I can make this thing seem just like the real wood for half the cost. So why wouldn't I do that, right? So here comes the discussion. Right. But if I was doing a $120,000 product, I'd make sure it had real wood because that's what the guy expects.
Okay, one last one. Chuck Grenchy from Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, wrote in. He says, I'm a current XT5, Cadillac XT5 owner, likes the vehicle, but he thinks Cadillac needs other offerings. Any rumblings of an XT3 or an XT4?
Let's just go to another question.
Okay.
Good question, Chuck.
Is that your
great question?
Is the XT5 yours?
The XT5 is mine, yes. Yeah. Yes, it is, absolutely. In fact, it was the first of this next generation family of these midsize that we rolled through.
But I think Cadillac has already, Johann Denation has already said that in order for Cadillac to be sustainable going forward, it's going to need a lot more.
Correct.
We know an XT4 is coming.
Correct.
So it's logical to assume that an XT3 is not going to be far behind.
XT4 is coming, and that would be the next one that would be a pretty exciting product.
Yeah,
for sure.
Cool. Look, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap this segment up, but Rick Smynans, thanks so much for coming in again. Always great to talk to you, and as you can tell, our audience has a zillion questions for you, too.
It's really nice that people care, Right. It's a fascinating business. I'll come back anytime you want. And thanks for all your questions. It's really appreciated. I wish I could answer them all.
Okay. Real good. We're going to take a quick break. We're coming back. We got some interesting things that we're going to be doing here, but stay tuned. Okay. We're back. And very interesting.
Yeah.
Boy, these crossovers have been red hot. James, you were saying sales really exploded last month.
Yeah, you know, according to Ward's Auto Data.
Jeez, why don't you put another plug in there? Is it Ward's?
Shameless.
Is that Ward's Auto Data?
Shameless, isn't it? Yeah, 65% truck last year. That includes crossovers. Mm-hmm. And that's a big reason that number is so high is because of the crossovers. Yeah. 68%
for
December.
The month. Yeah.
So, yeah, the market is flocking to CUVs. Crossovers.
And we're going to get into the sales numbers more in a minute, but right now we're going to try to phone in somebody who's been on the show before, Diane Phil Schneider, who, Gary, you'll remember because she pretty much runs the Concours d'Elegance at St. John's here in the Detroit area. Mm-hmm. But she's on this thing called the Drive Home, where they're driving classic cars from, I think, in Florida to the Detroit show, and she's en route right now. So I'm going to see if I can call her in and we'll get a report of what the heck they're doing.
And in fact, last year during the North American International Auto Show in Detroit, we had a guy who had driven to Detroit on the show from the drive home.
Yeah.
So what was he driving? Do you recall?
No.
Diane Schneider.
Hey, Diane. John McElroy.
Hi, John.
How you doing?
Doing great, thanks. And in sunny Florida.
Sunny Florida. Jeez.
It's sunny here, too.
Well, you're live on AutoLine After Hours right now, and we let the audience know that you're involved in something called the Drive Home. Tell us what it's about and what you're driving.
Well, the Drive Home is a collaboration between America's Automotive Trust and the North American International Auto Show. It's Drive Home 3, Driving the Future. What we're on is a 10-day road rally. It started yesterday in Boca Raton, Florida. It ends on the 12th at the North American International Auto Show, where all the cars that are involved will be on display.
That is so cool. All right, so what are you driving?
Well, I'm really thrilled that today I've been piloting a 1959 Cadillac Coupe de Ville, and I'm sharing the driving with a couple of young guys from Kettering University. The car belongs to Kettering. It was gifted to them by a professor, Reg Bell, who worked for 50 years consecutively as a professor at Kettering. And when he passed away, he gifted the car to Kettering University. So it's awesome.
Diane, this is Gary Vaslash. So are you driving or are these young guys doing the driving for you?
Am I what?
Are you, Gary wants to know, are you doing the driving or are the young guys driving for you?
No, I drove for a while today. Michael drove for a while today, and now Kip Darcy is at the wheel. So we take turns.
And how many cars are in this whole Peloton, as it were?
There are six vintage vehicles and one motorcycle. And also we have a 1928 GMC Terrain Sport support vehicle, but we have a 2014 Triumph motorcycle, a Thruxton, that's in our convoy. We have a 1972 Chevrolet El Camino. We have a 1969 Camaro, and a really cool vehicle, a 1962 International Travelette that's owned by Hagerty Insurance, a 59 Plymouth Fury, and then we have a 59 Chrysler 300 from the Nicola Bulgari Center. So it's really, really a cool convoy.
Well, you better tell the motorcycle, or better not tell the motorcycle guy that it's 8 degrees here in Detroit. I think he's going to want to turn around when you hit the Georgia border.
Well, we've been watching the weather pretty closely because we're driving 2,200 miles total, and our travels will take us to Birmingham, Alabama, to Greenville, South Carolina, Mooresville, North Carolina, Nashville, Cincinnati. So we're prepared. prepared for bad weather as much as we can be. Thanks to our sponsor, Michelin, we're running some great Defender tires on our car. Shell's been great. They're providing us with our fuel. We have Hagerty Insurance and State Farm, so if we do have a problem on the road, they provide support services for us. So, you know, Reliable's been great in bringing our car down here. So we anticipate bad weather, and the guy on the motorcycle might have to throw it in that trailer that is working as our travel truck. So,
Diane, when you go to these various cities, I mean, are you participating in events? So if some of our viewers are perhaps in Greenville or Nashville, can they see these cars?
We are. As a matter of fact, yesterday we were at Jason Winnig's creative workshop, and we had a lot of enthusiasts come out in the Miami Beach area, and it was really cold and rainy. Today we're going to Ace Cafe. We're almost there in Orlando, and they have an event there from 6 until 10 tonight. We hope about 500 motorcycles will come out tonight for two-wheeler night, they call it. So come on out to Orlando if you're around. We're going to Barber Motorsports on the 6th on Saturday. We have cars in Cocoa, and people will be able to take their cars out on the track for a nominal fee and meet all of us drivers. We're going to Hendrick Motorsports, Casa de Monte Cristo in Nashville. We'll be at the Corvette Museum in Bowling Green. So please come on out. And then when we arrive in Detroit, we'll be at Lincoln of Troy on January 12th. That's a Friday. And we'd love to have as many enthusiasts come out. We're going to do a Woodward Dream Cruise down to Cobo Hall. So anybody that can join us, come on and join us.
Well, that's great. Hey, Diane, thanks so much for this this update. And it's great to be able to connect with you on the show live.
Thanks, John, and we hope to see you at the Concord Eleganza America in July, and keep warm.
Okay, we'll do that.
Thanks. All right, take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
She's lucky. She gets to ride in a car, in a classic car, on a road trip like this with two engineers in the back.
Yeah, right.
I mean, anything happens, she's covered.
And free snow tires and fuel and insurance and all that stuff. That's the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mr.
So we're going to take a break and then do...
No. Let's just go. No, we'll have another break coming up, and then we'll do Dr. Data. But we got to get into some of the news that you wanted to get into.
Okay. Well, let's see here. All right. So I was looking around, and I was very surprised that there's a Japanese telecommunications company called SoftBank.
Yeah, I've heard the name, but I know nothing about it.
I mean, it's a telecommunications company. I mean, you can get your phone service if you're in Japan through this operation, and the company just invested in Uber and basically took a 15% position in it.
How much money was involved? Did they say?
It's in here somewhere.
That would give a new valuation on Uber.
Blah, 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 blah. $7.7 billion in Uber.
Yow!
Okay, so I looked into this. It has $4 billion in NVIDIA, which makes the chips that are being used by many companies to do autonomous driving. That's less than 5% of Uber. It has it purchased Arm Holdings, which makes chips and processors, for $31 billion. It has invested $159 million, not billion, the others are billion, this is million, in Noto, which makes cameras and analytics, $164 million in Mapbox, which makes mapping and navigation. It invested billions in Didi Chuxing, and those two invested.
Didi is the Uber of China.
Uber of China. And those two companies, so SoftBank and Didi, invested $2 billion in Singapore-based transportation and mobile payment company Grab Taxi. And it has nearly 84% of Sprint, the
U.S. Telco.
Telco company. So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking,
these guys got a lot of money.
Yeah. But they've got a lot of money in autonomous capability.
Yeah.
And it just struck me as being so odd. I mean, it would be like if AT&T or, you know, some other, you know, nominally phone company was investing this kind of money. So, you know, we think of Continental and Bosch and companies like this investing all this cash. But here's this company that is hugely investing in you know, the future of mobility. And it just seems very curious to me that they would be doing that.
That is amazing.
Industries no longer reside in silos. It's all becoming woven together.
That's a great point.
It's amazing.
Hey, you know, speaking of Japan and Japanese, we should mention Kenichi Yamamoto just died. He was this great executive at Mazda, started as an engineer. In fact, they credit him as being the father of the Wankel engine at Mazda. Mm-hmm. He later became president of the company. Very early, or a whole lot earlier in my career when I ran Automotive Industries magazine, we always had this Executive of the Year award that we would give and have a big luncheon and invite people from all throughout the industry. And it was a big deal at the Detroit Athletic Club and the like. When I was made editor in 1985, and I decided then that, hey, all we've ever done in the history of the magazine, which goes back to 1895, is nominate executives from GM, Ford, or Chrysler. So I thought, as the new editor, we got to break the mold, and we decided we were going to make Kenichi Yamamoto the man of the year. And, man, I thought it was the right thing to do. Mazda was red hot. They had just announced they were going to build an assembly plant in Michigan. But, wow, did that cause a major controversy in the company and amongst all our advertisers.
So they're going to run you out of town on
rail? Oh, they wanted to run me out of town on tar and feather me first and put a match to it and then run me out of town. But no, we literally had suppliers telling us, geez, if you're going to name a Japanese executive as the executive of the year, I don't think I can advertise in a magazine like that. Now, that was all a bunch of threats. Nobody ever pulled their advertising. But I got to know Yamamoto kind of well, in a way, because I had to do interviews with him, coordinate a lot with their people. The guy was terrific. And I think Mazda has never been as strong as when he was running the company. And like I said, this goes back into the 1980s, but he just died at, I can't remember offhand, like 93, 94 years old, something like that. But the industry just lost a good one.
You know, the Wankel engine was the it thing for a long time.
It was.
And it continues to be, you know, great power.
Very compact package.
Very compact. And so revolutionary in terms of engineering.
Yeah.
Except it didn't work very well. There's some problems with emissions and oil and things like that.
Yeah. You know, it's fantastic. You drive one and you realize what the attraction was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, but Gary's right. Early on.
You own one and you say, oh, my God.
Yeah. No, they had horrific oil burning problems. They couldn't get the tips of the rotors right. They finally got that all ironed out. But you're right. Even though it's a very smooth and high revving engine and very compact, not as fuel efficient as a piston engine.
It's interesting how much time and money was spent on trying to develop that, to perfect that technology. General Motors.
Right.
Even
Rick
GM.
Was just here. They spent a lot of time on that.
That's right. In fact, Mazda, even at one point, was going to do a hydrogen-fueled version of the rotary because they said it was so much more efficient than trying to make a piston engine run on hydrogen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thing, the whole notion of using internal combustion engines, whether it's a piston or Wankel engine. I remember Bob Stempel, the former chairman of General Motors, and he had been elevated to that position after he'd been the vice president of engineering, so he was a hardcore engineer guy. And I remember talking to him, and he was saying, yeah, you know, we have all these internal combustion engines, and we turn them to hydrogen, it wouldn't be a problem at all. And it's just like, you know, just need some seals and valves, and you're good to go. And somehow we haven't seen these, have we? It hasn't worked out very well.
Well, you know, then there's the hydrogen problem, you know, of where do you get it? Mm-hmm. And I imagine if hydrogen was plentiful and you could fill up anywhere, we'd see a lot of automakers seriously thinking about, why do a fuel cell? Why do a battery? Let's just make these piston engines run on hydrogen.
Mm-hmm. Because they have all the installed capacity to make all of these engines. And so,
I don't know, you drive one, and they're pretty good. They're getting really good at them now. Hyundai definitely has a...
You mean fuel cells?
Yeah, right. Very good one out on the market. Obviously, that's not a piston engine.
Honda and Toyota, too.
But,
right.
The idea of hydrogen and... At least the technology is coming along, the infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Once we're able to mine the sun, it's just full of hydrogen.
Yes.
Hey, let's take another quick break, and because we got to give a shout out to our friends at Lear, but then we got Dr. Data making an appearance.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back.
All right.
And so now it's time for Dr. Data.
All right. So this is a number that has something to do. So we've been talking about technology here, and we'll perhaps talk a little bit more about technology here. Okay. So I want you to think about this number in the sense of advanced technology. So Carmen, could you please bring the first number up? So here we have 1.39 million miles. Okay. So what could 1.39 million miles have to do with? And no, it has nothing to do with mining the sun.
I'm going to say that's how many miles GM's going to rack up with its autonomous cars every month this year.
James?
Oh, that was a good one, John. That was a good one.
You can agree with him.
I'm going to agree. I'm going to say that's the number of EV miles the Chevy Bolt has racked up.
Really?
Yeah.
You're both absolutely wrong. Carmen, bring up the answer, please. That's the miles of unpaved gravel or dirt roads in the United States. Now, that's basically a third of all of the roads in the United States, which is 4.07 million miles. And this is according to the American Road and Transportation Builders Association. So these guys are interested in building roads. So here's the thing that I wonder about. We talk about autonomous vehicles. We talk about hydrogen vehicles. And a third of the roads are gravel.
I like gravel roads.
But think about your autonomous vehicle that has cameras and all manner of sensors. They're gravel roads.
Yeah. So the gravel will be kicked up, so you got to put all those sensors behind some protective glass.
Yeah.
Well, in the automobile.
And then the glass will get dirty.
Yes.
And then the glass will have to be cleaned.
Yeah. They'll have little windshield wipers.
I mean, you guys are not astonished that a third of the roads in the United States are gravel?
Well, miles.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you get out into the Southwest and there's roads that go on and on and on and on that are just little dirt track paths. And it's, I'm telling you, in this area, driving around here, and I grew up in this area, which also it used to be all rural.
Right.
It used to be all dirt roads around here. Boy, it's hard to find a dirt road.
And as bad as roads are, the paved ones, you'd think they actually are gravel. Around here, but the automated vehicle is a more of an urban sort of solution, right? So isn't that kind of?
I don't know. If I have my level 5 car and I want to go to wherever,
it should be able to handle it. Even just because the road's gravel, sure, why not? You have your 3D map, your LiDAR, your sonar, your
lane markings.
Yeah.
Oh, there's no
lane markings. Jeez. Remember, the first two DARPA urban challenges were out on dirt roads in the desert with no markings of any kind. It can be done.
Yes, it can be done.
And President Trump has an infrastructure plan that's ready to go, so I think it may solve that problem.
Yeah. Okay.
All those roads are going to be paved.
Yeah. Just check. Right. Yeah, check back with us.
Well,
at the risk of getting political here.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, Gary.
What about sales? We got to talk about sales.
For 2017.
So 2017, the whole thing. James, what do you think?
Well, obviously another spectacular year. What have we had? 17-1 for the SAR. So another great year. Sales, obviously, you know, we've been tracking that. They've plateaued. A lot of the forecasts seem to be, at least from the automakers, optimistic. There are some bears out there, but I think when you look around at things like, you just look at the Dow and where the Dow's at right now, you know.
It's, record high.
Yeah, you know, 25,000, and it just continues to chug along. And, you know, I talk to people in finance, and they say there's no reason to see why we're going to experience a major hiccup. It's obviously withstood anything. Politically, you know, outside of the initial, you know, election there, so we're not going to see 18 million again. probably anytime soon, but from everybody that I talk to, we're still going to continue to have strong sales, and there's no reason to think otherwise.
Yeah, you know, part of my thought, too, is remember the last week of December has been this frigid weather that's covering most of the country. Some parts of the country getting slammed by blizzards. So I think that hurt car sales in December, and I think it's going to hurt car sales for January's numbers as well. I think it was a very good year, 17.1. It was about 17.4 million the year before.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you brought up earlier in the show, James, massive shift away from passenger cars into crossovers, SUVs, and pickups, which are more costly and generate more profits. So from the industry standpoint, it'd be very interesting once they announce all their financial numbers to look at, did revenue drop much at all, even though total sales were down? It might be pretty much even, Stephen.
Yeah, you think about demand and one of those things that's supporting it, you know, like, is the desire for a crossover. People want a new car. So don't ever discount, you know, you talked about the consumer resiliency. There's a snowstorm or something, they're going to come back into the showroom. You know, if there is some sort of hiccup to the economy or something like that, it's a postponement of a sale. But, people want the crossover. So that's going to help support sales, too, is they want the newest, greatest thing. That's our psyche. That's the way we're dialed in.
Right.
You know, it's interesting, just looking at a number which sort of surprises me is, you know, you're talking about crossovers, and I mean, this is a real data point that Camry sold, which the perennial best-selling car, and it is the best-selling car again, mm-hmm. but within the Toyota lineup, so it sold 387,081 units for calendar year 2017, but Toyota sold 407,594
RAV4s. Yeah.
So here we have, I mean, and that's a pretty considerable delta between those two numbers.
And remember that Camry number is down nearly 100,000 units from a decade ago.
Yeah.
So even though the Camry is the best-selling passenger car, it's down nearly 100,000 units from a decade ago. So it shows that even the best-selling passenger car is really getting it kicked in the teeth,
right.
You know,
I mean,
with this move to crossovers.
And new this year.
And brand new this year, mm-hmm. right.
So there would undoubtedly be some effect in terms of selling out the old model and bringing in the new model. That was interesting. The other thing that really surprised me when I was looking at the numbers is how well Infiniti is doing.
They passed Cadillac in total sales, didn't they?
It was close. That was my first reaction to it when I saw that number.
Yeah,
but I mean, so the Cadillac total is 156,440, and Infiniti came at 153,415.
So about 3,000 less.
Just a smidge less. But Cadillac sales for the year,
in December.
Well, they were down 28.6% in December. For the year, they're down 8%. Okay, yeah. But Infiniti is up 10.9%. So basically, what we're seeing is that Infiniti is, you know, increasing, and you know, could catch in pass Cadillac, as you're suggesting. There's the possibility of Nissan passing Honda in terms of sales,
right,
in the United States.
Right,
but you know, it just strikes me that you hear more about Cadillac, and it doesn't seem you hear that much about Infiniti. And yet here are these guys who...
That's a good point, Gary. That's a great
really
point. Yeah, Cadillac gets a whole lot more presence in the media, you know, coverage in the media, than does Infiniti. But Infiniti, I'm stunned at how sharply up it is this year.
So you
pretty good product.
GM, so what,
pretty good product.
So what's going on at Cadillac?
They don't have the right product.
Yeah.
And they sunk a lot of money into CTS.
And CTS was down, what, like 60%?
And they don't have the crossovers that they need. You know, you look at Infiniti
for the month for December.
XTS was down like 60%.
XTS down 60.9%.
I will say that in Infiniti and perhaps more parent company, Nissan, traditionally is a little more aggressive on the pricing.
Right.
Than nearly any other manufacturer in the U.S. But Cadillac's sucking wind. They need to get those They need to get those crossovers.
XT3 and XT4s.
Post haste.
Right. Is that going to make a significant difference, or is it going to make enough difference?
In the U.S., I think it'll make a difference in the U.S. Yes, I think it will. I think when you look at Cadillac, I think you need to look at Cadillac from a global perspective more than perhaps any other brand, not any other luxury brand, but than a lot of brands that, maybe an Infiniti, because their play is very much a global one, but still predicated on getting those small crossovers into their mm-hmm. lineup.
Yeah. China, I think they were up like 20% for the year, so mm-hmm. they're going gangbusters in China. But, yeah, December was a disaster for Cadillac.
Well, the thing is that Johann Denischen had been at Audi. But he'd been at Infiniti, too, come to think of it.
Yeah.
So he went.
That's right, yeah. He left Infiniti.
He left Infiniti to go to Cadillac.
And
he
Audi.
He left Audi, went to Infiniti.
Look at the
and
magic.
Then, and you look at the Audi numbers. I mean, so.
Bang up here.
So for their total sales, 226,511. That's up 7.8%. And I mean, so, when I hear people talking about how Cadillac will have these smaller vehicles, mm-hmm. I'm thinking, well, there's companies like Audi that have them now, and they're just doing great. Why would people suddenly want to say, oh, I want to go buy the Cadillac version? I don't understand that. Nobody seems to be talking about these Germans that are still hammering it out.
Yeah, that's up to the marketers to persuade them to get over it. That's what they get paid for. And
yeah, well, remember,
build a good product. Build a really good product. Market it properly.
Look, Cadillac got rid of their head of sales here. Ellinghaus, wasn't that the guy's name? Uwe Ellinghaus? Or am I mixing up names?
Uwe's head of marketing?
Was. He's no longer there. So I think that's indicative. And BMW also broomed out. They kicked their North American CEO upstairs, as they say. He's since left the company and brought in a new guy. Because they had a tough year for most of the year, although they really turned it around the last couple of months.
Yeah, they did fine in the month of December. They were up 4.3%, but they're down 2.4% for the year. And there's just a lot of red ink that goes right across the board in terms of what BMW is up to. I mean, Mini, holy moly, down 9.5%. And I mean, and their numbers are puny as it is. I mean, it's just
right.
Wow, how can you possibly afford to keep something like that going? I don't get it.
Well, speaking of that, and we've got some questions here, Model 3. Ron Paris wants to know, he says, if Tesla delivered over 2,400 Model 3s in Q4, why have I never seen a published road test of this product?
Didn't Motor Trend write up?
Motor Trend did have some sort of write-up, but I don't think they got the car from...
No, I think they did. I think that there was...
Oh, they got one.
Yeah, there was very big controversy because it was like Motor Trend was so adaptive and...
Accommodating. Well, anyway, Ron, the long story short is Tesla just doesn't make these vehicles, the Model 3 or the X or the S... Yeah. Available to the regular automotive media to test drive. They just don't do it. They don't think they need the media, and I guess they're right, but that's why you haven't heard anything about it. But, Gary, what do you make of only 2,400 or 2,500 cars in Q4? They just announced this week, Tesla did, that they're pushing back when they're going to hit line speed yet again. They had said that they'd hit line speed at the end of this quarter. Now they're saying, oh, guess what? Now it's going to be the end of the second quarter.
Well, this is the official word. Quote, in the last few days, we hit a production rate on each of our manufacturing lines that extrapolates to over 1,000 Model 3s per week. So if you just do it on paper, they're in brilliant shape. It doesn't matter. There'll be no problem. But the production hell is gone.
Yeah. That's more of their spin because 1,000 a week... They should be at 5,000 a week, and that's the first iteration, right? By this point, if you go back 2 years ago, right now they'd be making 10,000 a week.
All right, the official word, we intend to achieve the 5,000 per week milestone by the end of Q2.
I'll bet it doesn't happen.
I bet it doesn't happen either.
I think what they're going to do is for 1 week, they're going to hoard a bunch of parts, and then they're going to build 5,000 for that 1 week. And they're going to say, hey, we hit a 5,000 week rate.
No, they'll extrapolate and say that they could make 25,000 in a week, given their extrapolation.
Right.
I think they need to stop putting targets on their production. I know people want to see that. I don't think that Wall Street really cares about their production targets. I think the concern with if there's any concern with Tesla, I think it's more based upon other automakers or new startups, disruptors affecting their business, because Tesla has had the corner of this market and been the darling of the market, and the market is going to evolve and start to really put a challenge to Tesla. And that's the risk to Tesla.
All right, so you're saying that Tesla's concerned that others are going to eat its lunch, or the regular automakers are concerned that there'll be Tesla eating part of their lunch and the new entrants eating their breakfast and dinner?
I don't think Elon Musk is worried about it. I don't think he's worried about anything.
Right.
No, I'm just looking from a perspective as if you're looking at a company and you're looking at a company that continually does not hit its targets, you need to shut somebody up, first of all, and stop making targets. And second of all, let's look at what really is that a risk to Tesla's business? And if you look at how Wall Street has interpreted it, virtually every banker has said, we don't really care, because if their stock takes a little hiccup, it always bounces back. And so what I say is, you look at it as a company, I think the risk to them, yeah, they missed another one. Nobody really cares.
Right.
You know, what they need to be worried about is this growing competition that is encroaching on what has been they have owned the EV segment.
See, but I look at this. So BMW sold 6,276 i3s in calendar year 2017. The Chevy Bolt, on the other hand, 23,297. Okay? So it almost strikes me that, you know, you have the traditional, you know, Chevy kicking butt in terms of the number of vehicles it's selling, and, you know, even players that have such a great pedigree as BMW does not having an effect at all. So I don't know whether Elon is going to care about i3s or Leafs or you know, e-Golfs. I mean, the e-Golf number was just ridiculously low.
Well, it's a compliance car. It's not a really good EV. The Bolt, on the other hand, is, and they sold, what, about 3,200, 3,300 in December?
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty good number.
Yeah, 3,200.
It's also interesting to see that the Volt with the V as in Victor sales are dropping dramatically as Bolt with the B as in boy are soaring dramatically. And it looks to me like that's part of what's happening here right now.
Almost definitely.
People are coming out of their plug-in hybrids and saying, okay, here's a battery electric that's ready for prime time, at least for me, and I'm buying it.
I was talking to a dealer down in Texas, and I think he's the number one Volt retailer. And he was telling me that when people learned about the Bolt coming, they were timing the lease of the Volt that they were getting into to expire when the Bolt came out. So definitely Bolt is stealing sales from the Volt. And I still think for most people, the Volt is more sort of practical.
Sure.
Take on the EV. But anyway, they expect that should even out over time. But the Volt Bravo is definitely eating Victor's mm-hmm. lunch.
Look, I think Chevrolet sometime this year could hit a 5,000 a month rate sales with the Bolt EV. You know, with the kind of momentum I'm seeing right now, and as it's still not readily available in all 50 states. As they get that there, I could see it hitting.
They
about
better hurry up, though, because they got that Model 3 that'll be 5,000 at the end of Q2.
Well, I don't think they're going to hit 5,000 at the end of Q2. I don't think they're going to hit 5,000 a week consistently this year. And that's when I think that the investment community is going to go, wait a minute here, Elon. You know, we've been giving you a lot of leeway here. We've been forgiving a lot of sins, but maybe I ought to cash out some of my holdings in Tesla right now while I can.
All right, so I got to ask you guys about this FCA, for the year. Jeep down 11%, Chrysler down 19%, Dodge down 12%, Fiat down 19%, Ram up 2%, and Alfa up 2,232%.
I know, but the numbers are dinky.
I know, but
yeah.
So should Sergio be more nervous than Elon?
I don't think so, because, look, the one that really dragged them down was Jeep. And so you had the new Compass come out, and it got off to a slow start. It's going quite well right now. They've got the all-new Wrangler coming. Then they're going to have the Jeep truck next year and the Grand Wagoneer. And they've got a refresh coming of the Cherokee. I think you're going to see Jeep roar back in 2018 in the U.S. market. And I think that might be enough to carry the rest of FCA with it.
You got a new Ram coming.
And the new Ram pickup, so. Right.
It is interesting to note that, you know, mentioning Jeep, so Jeep is basically responsible for 828,000 units. And Ram is second at 556,000. Yeah. So the company is basically Jeep right now.
Yeah, Jeep and Ram. That's where they make all their money.
And
they've been starving the Chrysler brand and the Dodge brand to feed Maserati and Alfa Romeo. So
that's why Alfa's up 2,200%.
Well, I know it is, but again, what'd they sell?
Yeah.
2,000 vehicles for the whole year?
Oh, it's all in the details.
Yeah.
How about Ford? What do we think about them? I mean, the F-Series, once again, was it 41 years in a row that the F-Series has been the number one selling vehicle in the United States, and 36, 37 years...
as the number one vehicle.
Number one vehicle, yeah.
But, yeah, no, it's staggering. I mean, including the medium duties, they sold almost 900,000 F-Series. They sold nearly 90,000 just last month alone. It's like, those are unbelievable numbers.
So we're talking, and you're talking about, you know, Jeep and Ram carrying, you know, so, FCA pretty much, you know, quits making sedans, right? And we're talking about the shift all throughout the show.
Right.
From car to truck. And then, you know, you look at Ford, they're not going to refresh the Fusion. I mean, It's just the first truck.
The first thing to leak out is Ford's not going to redo the Fusion. They're going to drop. I think the Taurus, I believe, is going away. The Fusion sounds like it's going away.
Taurus
going away.
Fiesta, Focus, C-Max, Fusion, Taurus, GT, Mustang. That's their.
What? Well, GT and Mustang are good. They're golden. C-Max is probably going to get dumped anyway. And
Fiesta,
I don't know. Well, you know, you make them in Mexico, and they sell well in Mexico, I believe. And I think they export some of those to South America as well. So I can sort of see Fiesta stand, but, you know, as long as you're making them in Mexico, you can put a few on a train and ship them north to the U.S. market.
So, I mean, is it conceivable, though, that, you know, to your point, James, that you would have a car company not make cars?
Not make cars in the U.S.
Basically, they're offering basically our CUVs.
Yeah, I think the way the market's going, yes. I mean, there's a role for cars. I mean, mid-sized cars in the U.S. still make up. I mean, that's a huge segment. So there's no reason you shouldn't be there. But do you need the Impala and the Malibu? You know, obviously Impala's going away. You know, you don't need all these different vehicles. You do need something entry for somebody to get in. You do need, you know, I think an Econobox. You do need a family sedan, but you don't need the breadth that the industry has historically carried.
All right.
Well, I mean, for the year, I mean, in General Motors, the only division that was up for the year is GMC. What don't they have?
They don't have cars, baby.
Yeah, they sure don't.
Yeah.
And they make more profit than Cadillac, which is volume-driven. But
GMC kills it. There's no question about that.
Professional grade.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got a couple of other questions here from the audience. Maybe we ought to wrap this up. Kenya wants to know, are we going to touch on the new Silverado? What V8 does it have? We can't say. Okay, that's under embargo for another week yet. Pedal Foot Auto said, I recently heard that GM has large amounts of cash on hand. Would they consider a purchase of Jeep? You bet they would, right?
But would they sell it?
Going to sell it. Not in a million years, for the reasons we just talked about. Amato Lorenz says, active lane keep assist, active pedestrian detection, active collision avoidance should be standard in all trim levels. Safety should be more important than profit.
Well, I mean, and as Rick mentioned, I mean, companies like Toyota and Honda are beginning to make these packages, you know, right across the board and making it standard. And I think as time goes forward, they're going to be.
Yes, now, Brent, this is really new stuff.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, Rick made a great point. The supply base isn't there to make it standard across the board. You couldn't do it if you wanted to.
Right.
But to your point, Gary, I give it a couple of years, it'll be across the board on just about everything.
Mm-hmm. I can agree with him, too, because once you get in a car that does have all that, you know, we test drive these.
Right.
And that's great stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, just the blind spot alert is fantastic.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many times it saved me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, real good. Let's wrap this up. James Mann, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great having you
here.
Great
fun.
You're really good.
Gary, thanks.
And Gary, we'll keep on doing this sort of stuff, although I believe we're off next week, right?
Yeah.
Next 2 weeks.
Yes.
Because we're going to be at CES and at the Detroit Auto Show. Yeah. But we want you all to keep on tuning in because we will be back after that.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.